There's always going to be someone who has it worse than you do. There's always going to be someone who has it better than you do. And at the end of the day, that's just comparing. And comparison is not helpful for anyone.
Welcome to the Hey Presley podcast, where we give you the practical tools and inspiring conversations to pursue a higher quality of life. Through a variety of topics, we intend to show you that an exceptional life is available to anyone. I'm your host, Presley Hirsch, and let's dive in. Hi, friends. Before we get into today's episode, I just want to share a review from iTunes. This one is from AccuHealer Prana Lover, and it says in part, quote, "I love the quality and mix of content Presley delivers with her guests. I especially recently have enjoyed the episode, How to Declutter Your Life. Thank you, and I look forward to continuing to listen more," end quote. Your reviews and feedback just seriously mean the world to me, and so I like to highlight them now and again and say thank you and encourage you as a listener to leave a review if you haven't already. It only takes a second. It's super quick. You can do it right from your podcast app, and I may even share your comments on a future episode. So thank you so much for taking the time to leave that review. Now on to today's conversation. In this episode, I'm chatting with Dr. Mallory Fox. She's the owner of Foxy Fit, where she's been helping people move better and relieve pain for over 8 years through yoga, mindfulness, fascial stretch, corrective exercise, and other techniques. Her list of formal education and certifications is so long, so I won't share them all here, but one of the things that I really admire about her is her commitment to continuing to learn and grow and harness the latest knowledge when it comes to the body and mind and helping people really feel their best and, for a lot of people, finally feel pain-free. Mallory is also the survivor of a traumatic brain injury, and we kick off this conversation by talking about how she walked through that time in her life. And because I always like to keep things, you know, on this podcast really tactical for you, we focus a lot on what she did in her marriage to get through that, how you can support someone going through something that's life-changing or devastating, you know, in that feeling when you just want to help and you're not sure how to help. We talk about that and other practical tips that you can take away from her experience. We also talk about how to raise your level of self-awareness to identify if there is room for you to feel better than you do right now, either mentally or physically, what mindful movement is and why it matters, and so much more. I seriously got chills several times in this conversation, and I think you're really going to get a lot out of it. And if while you're listening or after you finish the episode, you want to share it, please just post a screenshot to your Instagram and tag me at Hey Presley and Mallory, which is at Dr. Foxy Fit. It's also in the show notes for you. So we see it and can thank you for listening. Sharing this show just helps it reach more people, and I am so appreciative of that. So please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Mallory Fox. Mallory, I'm so excited that you're here. Thank you for taking the time. I'm really appreciative that you're taking the time out today to talk to me. I think this is going to be a really good conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I love your podcast, and I couldn't be more honored and excited to be a guest today.
Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you. And I'm really excited to chat with you for a lot of reasons, but primarily two that really speak to me. And the first is that your incredible story of overcoming challenges, but also your line of work, because it's really aligned with a concept that I firmly believe in, which is that people often don't know how bad they feel until they feel better. Would you agree that that's like what you do, is helping people feel better?
Yes. I love how you said that. We can get so used to feeling this blah or being in pain, and we get numb to it.
Totally. Totally. So we're going to dive into that, but I want to start with somewhat recent events that kind of turned your life upside down, to put it lightly. I remember when I heard you speaking at Powerhouse Women on stage, and you said a line that just struck a chord with me, and I haven't forgotten it. And it was, quote, "I remember that right as my head was about to hit the steering wheel, I thought, I don't have time for this." And it literally gave me chills. It gives me chills now as I'm repeating it back to you. Because I have been there, where I am so busy and overextended and overcommitted, and that my schedule or what I've committed to actually seems more important than my safety or this big thing that's happening. So using that as a jumping off point, can you share about what happened and essentially how that changed your life going forward?
Absolutely. Thank you for letting me know that resonated with you. When I was getting ready to speak about my experience, it's like, okay, how much of that self-talk that we have do I want to include? Because even as I thought I don't have time for this. I knew that that wasn't a healthy thought. And so, you know, there was a little bit of shame in discussing that, but my goal and my commitment is to be authentic and to share as much as I can of what I've been through to help other people. So I'm so happy that that spoke to you, and I'm excited to talk about it. Pre-accident, I was an incredibly busy person. You know, to everyone in my life, it just looked like I was a high achiever and a perfectionist. And I really liked being successful and busy. I honestly wore it like a badge of honor. I loved being the go-to fix-it girl. And when this accident happened, I was newly married. I had just taught yoga at my husband's Air National Guard base. I voluntarily did that a couple times a week. I had a full schedule of clients. I was working on a mobility program for Major League Baseball and just getting ready to go out of town for a wedding and then continue education. And then we were going to move into our new house. So I just had a really full schedule, but that was every single day of my life from the time that I was, a teeny tiny child. So my way of being was just super busy. And I put a lot of my self-worth into what I knew, who I could help, how many things I could cross off of my to-do list, what else, how many people were like, oh, Mallory, I don't know how I could have done it without you. Mm-hmm. Like, I would always be like humble, like, oh, you would have done it. But then inside, I'd be like, uh-huh. And I didn't even know that, Presley. I didn't even realize how much I put my value in that identity.
That is so, yeah, I mean, not to interrupt you, but just like to highlight like that you were placing your self-worth on how many things you crossed off your list or how many people were impressed with the way that you could do things. That is so powerful. I really resonate with that. And I think a lot of high achievers do and maybe don't realize that they're doing that. So that I just want to underscore that.
And I had no idea. And honestly, if someone had said that to me, I would have said, oh, you're wrong.
Right. Right.
I just didn't know. Like my brain, our brains are programmed, and we can talk about neuroscience maybe on another day, but our brains are programmed to behave the way that we behave. And their number one goal is to keep us alive and doing what they know to do. So, little sidetrack aside, when my life came screeching to a halt, that day in August of 2018, like that's who I was as a person. So I was rear-ended, and you know, at the time it didn't feel like it was going to be a life-changing event. As is so often, you know, in life, you can look back at those pivot points, and that was a huge pivot point for me. By the next morning, I knew that there was something very, very wrong. I couldn't lift my head off of my pillow when I woke up. Mm. And that was the first thought where I was like, oh, this isn't normal. And so at that point, you know, I went to the doctor and received a diagnosis of a traumatic brain injury and was told that I needed to take it easy for a couple of weeks and that, you know, then I should start to feel better. And at that point, I was incredibly dizzy, very nauseous, horrible pain, both in my head, so a migraine, as well as through my neck, my spine. My vision wasn't staying steady. So if I were to look at you, it felt like you were on a ship, like you're moving everywhere and nowhere all at once. So it was very disorienting. And I was having trouble expressing what was going on. because it just felt like it took so much effort to form words. And so I have my research doctor brain that's like, okay, I understand logically. I've had a traumatic brain injury. All of these symptoms are considered normal for a traumatic brain injury. And yet, what is going on with my brain and my body? Like, my brain and my body are not responding the way that I'm used to. It affected me emotionally. I went from being a really strong, independent woman to, I can't tell you how many times I just started bawling or laughing, or I was not in charge of my emotions. And you know, with the brain injury, again, like, our brains regulate everything that we do. And you know, the doctor had told my husband, expect a lot of mood swings. She's not going to be herself for a little bit. And again, like, logically, I knew that was true. And yet there was that part of me that was like, it's not going to be that way for me. Like, right. I'm super.
I'm different. Like, because I am so strong and independent, I'm going to handle this differently.
Yes. Because it's like, really my thought was, I have all these tools. I help people with these things for a living. Surely I will be better. You know, he says 2 weeks, I'll start to feel better. I'll be feeling better tomorrow. And that was my expectation.
And that's so interesting. I was going to bring that up too, that you had worked with traumatic brain injury patients and people that have gone through similar experiences prior to this happening to you, right?
Yes.
Which is crazy. I had Coach Dar on the podcast. I think she was episode 25 or 26. And she worked in like a stroke hospital with stroke patients before she had her stroke, which I was like, what are the chances of that? So it's pretty crazy that you had a lot of experience actually with TBI before it happened to you.
It really is. And so again, even though I know about it from, you know, a research standpoint, and even though I've been exposed to it through working with professional athletes and, you know, people who were in car accidents just like mine, even then I still had this level of denial, which I realized now was to protect me. Because my identity was so tied to being the person who didn't need help and to being the helper. My identity really couldn't let me face that yet, that I was going to need help. And what it turned into was I lost my eyesight, my left eye. My brain had shut my eye off at one point. I couldn't drive for 6 months. I was legally blind in my left eye. I had to go from doing everything on my own all the time to having to ask for help with everything in my life. There were days where I was so nauseous and dizzy and my head just hurt so badly. And I'd fallen several times because my eyesight was so bad and my disorientation. I broke my finger because I couldn't, you know, my vision just wasn't working. You know, I was really, for the first time in my life, just completely vulnerable and helpless, and had to learn how to ask for help and did not know how. You know, again, you think it would be really easy to say, hey, Presley, I'm legally blind and I can't drive. Do you mind coming over and driving me to the grocery store so I can pick out groceries? And yet I didn't have the capacity to, one, figure out how to pick up my phone and call you or text you. Two, get past my ego and say, hey, I can't do this. And, you know, three, like, put it all together. You know, those were like executive processing skills that suddenly I didn't have. What really helped my husband to figure this out, and I think what's really important to note too, I looked like myself the whole time. So brain injury is an invisible injury. In most brain injuries, you're not going to look at someone and know that anything is wrong with them. There are often very few physical symptoms. And so, you know, suddenly I went from being, you know, a 32-year-old doctor of health science, in a helping profession. And suddenly my brain was processing at the speed of a 5-year-old. And when my, doctor, you know, told us that after the testing, that's when my husband, Brian, really started to get it. Like, okay, essentially, like, I was processing things at the speed of a kindergartner. And that is also something that really helped me to change my expectation for my recovery and for my day-to-day. You don't expect a kindergartner to figure out how to call a friend and ask for help to create this grocery list and get these groceries. Like, that's what parents are for. And so I just had to suddenly accept that, even all of the things that I was doing, you know, I was going to physical therapy 3 times a week, going to occupational therapy 3 times a week, going to speech therapy 3 times a week, doing all of these things, and then adding vision therapy and coordinating my schedule. That took a lot. Like, that takes a lot even for a healthy adult. And yet I was expecting myself to do all of this seamlessly without help with a brain injury and an eye injury.
Yeah. That, when you said, that gave me goosebumps when you said that you can't see a traumatic brain injury most of the time, because I have had things like, I deal with endometriosis, and I have said to my mom before, I almost wish my leg was just broken, because then people would understand when I didn't feel good, you know, and you have good days and bad days. And when people can't see your bad days physically, it's tough, because then it's like, you're always having to explain it. And then you're like, I'm just not even going to explain it. So then you're putting on a facade, and then you don't feel authentic. And then that's energetically draining, and people can't see you, but you're just nodding your head like, yup. And not to compare, you know, everybody's journey is different, but I have experienced those things personally, and it sounds like you have too. And so that's just such a big, like, what a lesson for life, that a lot of us are dealing with things that could be causing us either physical pain or emotional pain, and we actually can't see them on other people. That just, I think, is so powerful. When you talked about changing your expectations, something that I think is interesting too is, not only did you have to change your expectations for yourself, but your husband had to change his expectations, right? Like, he's relearning how to communicate with you. And, you know, by you going through this, it's, he like has to adopt patience and has to adopt a new set of expectations. Tell me about how you navigated that in your relationship. Cause you said you'd only been married like a year at that point.
We'd been married for 4 months.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm going to preface this by saying, Brian, I love you very much, and I'm very grateful for you. And that was an incredibly challenging. There were points, especially early on, where I honestly thought it would be so much easier to not be married right now, because Brian and I are both strong people. We're both independent. We're both stubborn. And Brian's, he has 26 years in the military, and he's been a cop more than half his life. So he is not the most patient or empathetic person. He has so many great qualities, and those aren't his strong suits. So it was really easy for me to focus on how things affected me. And I wasn't at all a good partner for him at that point either, because I could barely process what was going on for myself, let alone process the losses that he was facing as a newlywed, as suddenly having something happen that even he didn't understand. And of course, he couldn't understand my injury, because I was living it and I didn't understand it. And, you know, thank goodness for therapy and support, because we wouldn't have gotten through this process. Gosh, I wouldn't have survived this without the tools that we have and the network that we have. And honestly, like without each other, because I couldn't even explain to him. I didn't know this, but this is common with brain injury, that I would just stare at him. Like he'd ask me a question and I would just stare at him and, you know, he'd get frustrated because I wasn't answering him. And it would be something simple. Like, do you want, you know, whole milk or 2%? And just like that, you know, time would go by.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd be like, hello, do you want?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, and in my brain is just frozen. Like having to suddenly process what's whole milk, what's 2% milk, wait, he seems upset. You know, all of the things that our brains automatically interpret as information and data. Mine was just getting stuck on putting words together that make sounds that are supposed to mean something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't explain that. And again, I look perfectly normal. I look perfectly fine. And when you said that you often wish that you had something visible, yes, I went through so much of, I wish that, this is terrible. I honestly wished at one point that I had cancer because people understand cancer. Mm. People don't understand brain injury or endometriosis or fibromyalgia or mental health issues because we can't see them. So this has given me a lot more empathy for others and what other people are going through. Because it was really, really, really difficult to have to explain over and over again to people.
Yeah.
I know I look okay and I'm not okay. Yeah. It was even just hard for me. You know, I grew up as an athlete. It's hard for me to say I'm not okay ever. I was always okay. I was always great. Even when, you know, my heart was broken, I was always great because that's what I learned as at a young age, we tell other people. And so to even say to someone, I'm not okay. I've had a brain injury. Here's what you can expect from me.
Yeah.
Here's what you can't expect from me. And I remember I would remind him sometimes, we did this thing. We ended up writing out like, I'm forgetting the word, but that's still part of the brain injury. I still have some symptoms. Those little cards, index cards.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we wrote out, this was at the recommendation of, I think, my occupational therapist. We would write out answers. So if I needed him to give me a minute to process, like I would have this little card.
Mm.
And say, like, I need to process. And that way I wouldn't have to try to come up with, because inside I would feel all this panic of, okay, someone's standing in front of me. They need me to answer something. They need me to act. And I would get, you know, my symptoms would get worse. My headache would get worse. My breathing would, you know, get shallow because I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't remember how to get out that message. So I would just have a 4x6 index card. Be like, I need to process. Yeah. Or I need to breathe. And then that was really helpful because that would help him too, to remember, okay, she looks like herself, but she's not herself.
Yeah. And how amazing is that, that you were able to find tools that could make navigating your relationship and your day-to-day at least a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. What kind of, I'm curious what kind of symptoms you still experience. And then I'm also curious with that, what other tools have been super valuable for you? You mentioned going to, you know, like some kind of talk therapy and occupational therapy and vision therapy and all these different things. What tools have you found to be really helpful for you both, you know, in your relationship and on the road to recovery?
Oh gosh. Great question. Okay. I'm going to hopefully not forget anything, but at one point, yeah, I had 9 different therapists.
Wow.
Yeah. Occupational therapy and vision therapy. So I needed to obviously get my eyesight back, which I'm really happy to report I have.
Amazing.
Yeah. And physical therapy. I've had 3 different physical therapists, 4 different things. So you can have a therapist who specializes in brain injury. Mm-hmm. You can have a physical therapist who specializes in TMJ, which I developed after the accident. So I had those medical professionals. I have an incredible neurologist at Barrows Concussion and Brain Injury. I've actually had now 3 different neurologists there. One specializes in migraines, which I, you know, had a daily migraine for 10 months with no relief. So I got transferred to her care about 10 months in. And that's what she does every single day, is helps people with chronic migraines.
Wow.
Yeah. Gosh, I've seen a specialist for the nerve issues I developed after my accident. So I get a tremor in my jaw when I get overstimulated. That became one of the signs to me that I was doing too much. If I would start tremoring, I'd be like, oh, okay, my brain is tired. This is time to rest.
Yeah.
What are some of the other specialists? Speech therapy. I went through 2 different stints of speech therapy. So they helped me with things like, so I've always had an incredible memory. And for a really long time, I couldn't remember anyone's name, not even, and this is really crazy, not even like, sometimes I'd forget my husband's name. And it's, you know, I could geek out over how memory works and how the brain works, but I had to relearn how to remember people's names and faces. And the word retrieval skills, so I used one of those actually already in the podcast when I couldn't remember what an index card was. So I was able to remember the steps to start to explain, okay, it's, you know, a little rectangle,
yeah.
You write things on it. So those are all tips actually that I still use sometimes when I either have so much I want to say that my brain just can't bop out as quickly, or if I'm, you know, thinking of another thought. So that was a good example of a tool I use.
Yeah.
And vision therapy. I went to vision therapy once a week for a year and worked with an awesome therapist there. And then I had homework I did every day. And I've had 3 different therapists for psychotherapy who've helped me so much. One specializes in working with people who've had chronic illness suddenly change their lives. She's been a godsend to me. I did EMD therapy for PTSD, and that was really helpful. I had to stop because it made my brain symptoms and eye symptoms a little bit worse. So took a break from that. And gosh, I've had so many resources and tools. And I would say the most important resource has been my community.
Mm.
So the people around me who've loved me and accepted me each day, no matter what I brought to the table or didn't bring to the table. I had never allowed myself to be supported by others. And so I would say that is one of the best resources that I've developed through this.
Yeah. And I actually wanted to ask you about that because I am curious, you know, I think when people, and I shouldn't speak for everybody, but with myself, like when I've gone through an injury or gone through something significant, I don't know, like people be like, how can I help? Or let me know if you need help. And I'm like, I don't really know how you can help. And it's a nice sentiment, but I'm sure other people have been in situations, and I know I have, where something happens to somebody that I love and I'm like, how do I help you? And like, I don't know how to help. So were there things that you needed specifically from your support system, or ways that your husband showed up for you or your community showed up for you that you found really helpful?
Yes. Yeah. Great question. Because it's also difficult, you know, when you're someone, if you're grieving, you know, a loss, or if you're, you know, going through like a medical issue, I was grieving a lot of losses. And so having to figure out how someone could help can be overwhelming. And so I absolutely had to learn how people could help. And then also, keep connected with people throughout that. So, I messed it up really badly from the get-go. Like in the beginning, people were always offering to help, and it overwhelmed me so much that I isolated.
Mm.
And so I learned a lot from that experience. So what I would suggest to people, if you want to help someone else who's going through something, put a reminder in your phone for, like, check in with them in the beginning. But then, it really meant a lot to me, the people who came back a few weeks later just to follow up. And that's something that I'd always taken on myself to, be the one who always remembered to follow up. It meant so much to me when people just randomly reached out down the road and just to say hi and ask how I was doing. I lost a lot of friends through this because I changed and I wasn't who I used to be. My Facebook friend list, my, you know, cell phone contact list, that's changed drastically throughout this. And so, if you're a person who's able to be there for others when they need it, I think that's a really great way to support and to help. Another incredibly helpful thing was when someone just offered me something.
Mm.
My friend Rebecca is such an incredible person. And what she does and still does is she will say, "Hey, I'm free Friday evening. Can I come pick you up? And can we go for a drive? Mm. Or can I bring you a coffee?"
It's very specific. Yeah.
It's very, very specific, which I so appreciate because I only have to decide yes or no.
Yeah. You don't have to think about when or what or yeah.
Yeah. So if you're working and that's obviously specific to brain injury, but really to anyone who's dealing with chronic pain or anything like that, it's so helpful because it takes away the decision fatigue.
Yeah.
Well,
not brain injury, just anything that, yeah, people are going through, you're just energetically spent. So not having to think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when people would say to me, and people do this like so well-meaningly, but like, let's say that you would say, "Hey, Mallory, I'd love to get together and help you. When are you free?"
Hmm.
So then I need to look through my calendar. I need to figure out transportation times. I need to figure out, okay, if I'm going to Uber to you, then I need this much time and it's going to cost me $12 to Uber and I'm not working. Like, it sends me down a rabbit hole.
Right.
As a patient. And what if I wake up with a migraine that day? Like, I know how busy you are. Are you going to be okay with waiting a half hour for me to get my act together? Or, you know, or am I going to have to just cancel on you at the last minute? Like, I'd come up against all of these things that would paralyze me.
Yeah.
And it would just become so much easier because I didn't want to let you down. I didn't want to be flaky. I didn't want to inconvenience anyone. There were the questions that are like, "Well, I know she said, you know, this person has said, hey, if you ever need a ride somewhere, let me know." Again, I so appreciate that. But then it's like, well, okay, if I ask this person, can you take off work and drive me down to Barrows? That's a half hour away, and sit in the lobby for an hour and a half for my appointment and then drive me back home. Like, do you mean that? Or do you mean, you know, if you need a ride down the street?
Right. Oh, I think so helpful, because I think that we've all been in positions where we want to help people that's going through something tough. And the situation is the same, where people don't know exactly what you mean. They don't want to inconvenience you. They want to take you up on your offer maybe, but don't have the space to make all the decisions. You said something that I think is really important to highlight too a little bit earlier about grief and grieving these losses. And this is April 3rd that we're recording this, and we're in the thick of coronavirus and you know, staying at home and all of the things. And I read online somewhere that, you know, a lot of people are experiencing grief depending on how they've been impacted by this, because grief can very simply be defined as a lot of change at once. And so there are some people that are going through a lot of change at once right now. And so I think a lot of times we only associate grief with a loss of a person or a loved one, but it actually can be applied in a lot of different ways. Grieving the loss of your old life, the loss of the ability to do yoga like you used to do it. Like, I'm sure the list goes on and on, but I think that's an important distinction, is that if you can identify it as grief, it almost opens up this whole world of resources. Because when you can't, I think it's Brené Brown that talks a lot about like labeling your feelings. So if you can label it as grief, then I would imagine it's like, okay, maybe I can look at resources that about grief and start to feel like there's some support there.
Yeah. Yes. I'm so glad you said that, because I didn't understand that I was grieving. I mean, yes, a horrible injury had happened. And yes, I was, how do I want to say all of this? So I would almost shame myself out of grief.
Yeah.
Because, and sometimes people would do this too, again, not meaning to, but I was in an accident and I survived. Great. I should be happy that I'm alive. It shouldn't matter to me that I can't drive, or, you know, I'm suddenly a different person. Like, I didn't know I was allowed to grieve that I got married 4 months before and our lives as newlyweds changed immediately. Because people would say to me, oh, well, you're so lucky that you guys have each other. I didn't realize I was allowed to grieve that, you know, newlywed bliss. There was so much, and I remember such a powerful exercise I did with my therapist was labeling everything that I needed to grieve and then seeing it in writing. And even right now, like, I have tears in my eyes, seeing all of those losses in writing was like, oh my gosh. And so giving myself the space to grieve, and still being like, yes, it's such a complicated process. And and that's one thing too with, and I'll speak about coronavirus. So everyone in the world is grieving something right now. Loss of a job, loss of income, loss of freedom, ability to travel. They might be first world problems, some of them. And so I know a lot of people will shame themselves out of grieving a first world problem, because there are people way worse off than we are, but it's just as valid pain and suffering and loss. You know, kids who are seniors in high school and won't get to go to prom. There's so many different types of grief and loss happening right now in the world. And it sucks. It really sucks. But my advice to anyone, you know, because honestly, when this airs, I'm sure that people will still be processing the grief and loss of spring 2020. And so my advice to anyone going through that is, yeah, label it. Write down every single thing. Because I'll tell you, when I was going through the worst of my TBI, it wasn't the physical pain. It wasn't the loss of big things like work and driving and health. What would break me some days were those tiny little things. Like I was with a friend at a coffee shop and she was trying to get me to just be myself again. Like she wanted to fix it for me. Mm-hmm. And she was like, well, what, you know, you've got all this time off work. What do you want to do? Like, what would you want to do? And I just said to her, I want to be able to sit in this coffee shop and enjoy being here and not have my body telling me that the whole world is spinning. Like, I want to just be able to sit here and take a deep breath and feel good. And so it was even just the loss of having moments that really broke me. And also having her not understand mm-hmm. that it was something that was just inaccessible to me.
Yeah. You raised such a powerful point. And I don't know that there is an answer necessarily, at least that, you know, we could deduce in a podcast, but it's like, how do you explore holding place for both in terms of gratitude mm-hmm. and appreciation that you are alive and you made it through the accident and that you have your husband and all of these amazing things. But, and I am very centered in gratitude and that's a huge part of my core belief system and my daily practice. But I have noticed that when there's more challenging times, it's almost like if you're so focused on the positive that you don't acknowledge the grief, you can't actually believe it maybe, or you're in denial, which doesn't allow you to move through it. And so, and I have definitely had conversations with friends who clearly need to grieve something and, or acknowledge that something sucks and are like, oh, this is a first world problem. Or I know other people have it worse. And it's like, it's how do we find that balance of, and this is more of a rhetorical question, but it's like, how do we find that balance of being grateful while still acknowledging that things can be hard? And just because somebody might perceive to have it harder doesn't mean that your heart is not okay.
Yes. So again, thank God for therapy.
Yeah.
because that's what actually drove me to go to therapy. I never thought I needed it. I was like, I'm a strong person. I don't need therapy. Mm-hmm. But it was to process through those things, because I would say a tool that helped me so much was writing a permission slip for myself. And it was giving myself permission to grieve. And sometimes, you know, for a period of time. giving my body permission to do what it needed to do to grieve, because my entire body has changed through this and, you know, continues to be different each day than, you know, what I'm used to. And it was giving myself just the permission to feel what it was that I was feeling. I've learned a lot actually about toxic positivity. And again, that might not be a topic to get into today, but what you're explaining about, you know, balancing gratitude with the real of what's going on, like a toxic positivity is like leaving no space for any type of grief, because there's always going to be someone who has it worse than you do. Right. There's always going to be someone who has it better than you do. And at the end of the day, that's just comparing. And yeah, comparison is not helpful for anyone. And just what I have incorporated into my day-to-day is a gratitude journal. So I do every single day write down three things I'm grateful for. And I do give myself the space each day to grieve whatever it is that comes up that I need to grieve. And I've become really selective about who I share these things with too. In the beginning, I thought that I owed everyone who asked me how I was doing, like the real answer. And now I know that I don't owe everyone the real answer, because sometimes it's more painful to have to explain to someone and have them say to you, oh, well, but you're alive. Like, mm-hmm. You should just be grateful you're alive. Or, oh, well, you look great. So, right. I mean, just sometimes like putting yourself out there vulnerably and having it, and you know, it's not really on that person. I think that if you haven't experienced life-changing loss, then you don't know how to respond to someone in that space, because you just can't understand it because you haven't experienced it.
Yeah.
And so there are people who really mean well, but can, you know, make it worse. And I know that I was that person before too.
Yeah.
Well, even I would think, you just need to work harder, people.
Right. It is kind of funny, isn't it, that we just assume that people know how to respond in the way that we need. Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Yeah.
It is such, well, and I really appreciate you being so vulnerable and really speaking to how all these things have helped you, and particularly therapy, because I had Dr. Morgan Francis on the podcast, who I know that you know very well also.
Yes.
And she and I really talked about how do we get rid of this taboo around therapy, because whether you've gone through a life-changing event or something that maybe isn't life-changing or something that feels like a life-changing event to you personally, I think that there's a lot of value in it, and continuing to break down that wall of it's okay to go talk about these things, because we don't all have the space, or we're not creating the space to do it in a safe way. So I appreciate you.
Yes. Thank you. She was my first therapist.
Oh, she's great. Yeah. She's so good. So yes. I do want to pivot a little bit, because I know our time is limited, and I want to actually get into what you do professionally, because I have been a client of yours and I know how unique what you do is. So can you share more about what you do in your business and who you work with?
Ah, so I'm a movement specialist and love doing it. It wakes me up, and I do that through a bunch of different modal assisted stretching, some soft tissue work, and a lot of corrective exercise.
That's amazing. And do people come to you only when they're in pain, or what kind of, what leads somebody to find your services?
So people, good question. What I specialize in now is when people are in pain. So post-injury or post illness, when someone's body has changed or their mobility has changed, that's when people seem to be most motivated to come in. And I can completely relate to that now. I've been at a point myself where I'm like, I will literally try anything to get better. And so I do get a lot of people who've, again, you know, they've had things change within their body. And so they want some guidance on how to adapt and how to practice resilience to change habits and move better so that they then feel better. And then when people feel better, then they live better.
Absolutely. And this is going to sound like a silly question, but I think you're going to get what I mean, which is, how can people identify if they're actually feeling their best? Because you know, it's like, how do we increase that self-awareness to say that, you know, pain or uncomfortability doesn't have to be your normal? I know that in my nutrition coaching practice, I had spoke with several people who were like, oh no, I just have back pain. Or like, no, I just like, I have a, you know, that's just a bad shoulder. Like it's like, they've just chalked that up to who they are. But I personally believe that that kind of continuous pain really takes a toll when you're not realizing it. So how do we get people to acknowledge that they might not be feeling their best?
That's such a great question. And, you know, because again, like based on my experience of living with chronic pain for a year and a half, it's completely changed how I address it with others, because I had completely forgotten what it felt like to not have a migraine.
Mm.
And, it was in June of last year. I'd had a migraine every single day for 10 months. And I woke up in the morning and I was like, wait, I almost didn't even know what it was, but I felt good. And I woke up early and I was moving around pretty easily. And, you know, Brian even noticed. And it just hit me. I don't have a migraine. And so when people come to me and, you know, we always have reasons for why we're in pain too. Like, oh yeah, like it's just, I've had this shoulder problem forever. Or I'm getting old. That's the thing that I get all the time. Yeah. Anyone over 25 who comes to see me, well, you know, I'm just getting old, so I don't expect that I'm ever going to feel good again.
Right.
And I hear this from like a 30-year-old baseball player and I'm like, stop it. So, there's some miseducation, I would say, with a lot of people. And I think helping people understand how the body works, so getting deep into science, can help, because again, they just don't know any different. So I focus a lot on education. I use a lot of tools like mindfulness to help people tune into what's actually going on. Sometimes when people come in and they, you know, have had, you know, this shoulder problem forever. Well, it turns out that they're carrying a 30-pound purse on that shoulder all the time. And something simple like taking that stressor away and then doing some tissue work and retraining the muscles, you know, will take the pain away. And they're like, I've forgotten what this feels like. And I know I'm getting a little bit off track, but I think giving people hope again, because I hit a point where I was like, okay, this is just how my life is going to be. I've done everything right. And I'm still stuck in this spot. So this is just how my life is going to be from here on forward. And that led to depression, that led to anxiety, that led to a lot of mental health concerns I'd never dealt with before. And allowing myself to get support and help in those areas ultimately is what helped me to realize I could feel better again.
Yeah. And yeah. I remember chatting with you in your office about how I bet you're the last stop for a lot of people because you do blend these modalities. And I would imagine, at least in Western medicine, we start with, you know, our primary tells us to go to a PT. And then if we don't see relief there, then our PT tells us to go to a specialist PT. And it's like, we kind of follow these steps. And I don't know that what you do is necessarily traditionally on this step-by-step path. And so I would imagine that a lot of times people get to you and are like, okay, like what do you got? Because I've tried everything, you know? So it's probably fun to be able to restore that hope for people.
It is really fun. And thank you so much for saying that. I think what I do the best is connecting with people. And what I've learned through my own experience is that, you know, when someone's seen all of these specialists, I'm a big nerd. So I look at all of that information. I confer with people's physical therapists. I do all of that to be a good practitioner. But then what I think I do the best is I listen to what the person is saying to me and just like that is just as important as what the MRI says to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then my favorite thing to do is help to re-educate. You know, that people really think, okay, I've got, you know, this deviation in my spine, and that means I'm always going to have this terrible pain down my leg. And that may be medically true, but what I help people to do is foster resilience so that they can learn how to adapt and support. There are still things that we have control over, even when we have an illness or an injury. you know, we still have control over our choices. So creating routines that help that person with chronic leg pain, creating routines and re-educating and providing tools and resources to give people their power back, I think is what's most important.
Absolutely.
And often it's, you know, grieving the loss. So I will now refer people to mental health specialists because I'll say, hey, I went through this. And here's what helped me. And when, you know, someone they trust tells them that, then it takes away some of the stigma. Mm-hmm. And will really help because we try to treat our bodies like, you know, these compartmentalized machines, but they're not. And I have goosebumps right now just, you know, talking about that because the human body is so incredible and capable of so much. And when people lose hope, you know, that breaks my heart because I've been there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's really what's changed my business since I got back to work was, you know, before I was very clinical. And now it's like, it's not just about surviving the storm you're in. It's about thriving.
Absolutely. That's, mm-hmm. I remember when I was talking to you in your office about my TMJ and jaw pain. And I was like, oh yeah, I wear the guard at night and whatever, you know, I do X, Y, Z to try and help it. And you said something to the effect of, when you catch yourself clenching your jaw during the day, what do you say to yourself? And I was like, I don't know. Nobody's ever asked me that. It like knocked me off my feet. I was like, I don't know. I need to think about this for a sec. What do I say to myself when I realize I'm clenching during the day? But it's, I mean, I've thought about that a lot is like since that day, however many months ago that was, is what am I telling myself about the pain that I'm experiencing? Because that I think is huge. And you started to talk about mindfulness. I've spoken with many people on this podcast about mindfulness, but you bring a twist to it that I think is really cool, which is mindful movement. And I know that you launched your first mindful movement course this month, which is amazing. So what is mindful movement and why is that so important?
Ooh, yeah. So mindfulness, like we all know that it's beneficial to us and we all know that movement is beneficial to our bodies. It helps us to release stuck energy and essentially like work through things. And with mindful movement, it's really just practicing awareness of what's happening in that moment at that time. And one reason it's so important to me is like when I would wake up in the morning, like in, you know, the worst part of my brain injury symptoms, I would have to immediately assess what's going on with my body today. What are my symptoms and how can I support myself around what I'm feeling? And I realized that we don't do that. I'd never done that before in my life. My alarm would go off. I'd maybe hit snooze, but I'd, you know, catapult out of bed, drink coffee, run out the door, and I'd just go until I collapsed at night. And so mindful movement is just giving yourself a little bit of time and space to check in with your body. It could be 30 seconds. It could be 5 minutes. It could be an hour. It can be, you know, anything. Could be walking, it could be specific exercises, it could be breathing.
Love that. So yeah. Good.
Yeah. And
my last few questions for you. The first being, what are you most excited about right now?
I'm most excited about my course. It's day 3 of the 30 days. And when I started to build this course, I knew how important community was to me. It's one of my core values, especially because, you know, again, like with what I've gone through the last couple of years, I wouldn't have gotten through it without my people. And so I created the course with the cornerstone being community. And so seeing everyone interact in the course and connect And these are people who on paper, like when people were registering, I was like, okay, how is this going to work? You know, there's like my, my 70 some year old mother-in-law, there's like people from Canada and people from, you know, professional athlete and, you know, I mean, TBI survivors, like the group of people who signed up, I'm like, oh, I hope this works. And by the end of day one, Presley, I just was beaming because people had already connected and were finding shared values, shared experiences. And it just felt so good that at day one, like that's what was happening. I'm like, I cannot wait to hear, like by the end of the 30 days, like the connections that people have made. And you know, let alone like the mindfulness exercise. We have a new mindfulness exercise every day, a new guided mindful movement every day. It's like 15 to 20 minutes of yoga, some stretching, some corrective exercise, all kinds of things. A journal prompt so that people can really dig deep and look at themselves, and then a sharing discussion. And again, that's where people find, okay, I'm not the only one. Okay, great.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm most excited about right now.
I love that. Where can people connect with you online to learn more about your courses? Because I know you'll be running more of these mindful movement courses. So where can people sign up for that or hear about events that you're doing if they're local to Arizona and all the good things?
Yeah. I'm on Instagram. It's Dr. Foxy Fit, DrFoxyFit. And that is something that I'm active on every single day. And then my website, go ahead and subscribe to my newsletter. And people will get a free download of a mindful morning movement routine that they could get started with. But my email list always gets like the very first sneak peek at what's coming up. They get first access to signing up for events and courses and sometimes even little discounts and freebies. So,
Love it.
Mm-hmm. My website is befoxyfit.com.
Perfect. No, that's important. I'll put all of that in the show notes too, so that people can access it super easily. And great. My last question for you that I ask everybody is, what do you believe are the ingredients of a fulfilling life?
Community.
That was a quick
people,
one.
Yep. The people that you live life with, health, because how you feel impacts every single aspect of life. And then the last thing is passion, finding what lights you up, finding what gets you out of bed in the morning, and hope. So that's the fourth thing. Yeah, hope.
I love that. This has been amazing. Thank you so much for your time. I can't wait for people to hear this. I think that they're really going to get a lot out of your message. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Presley. It was so much fun to chat with you. And I just so appreciate your thoughtful questions. It made it so easy to have an hour go by quickly.
I know, that went by fast.
Yeah.
Hey guys, before you go, I just want to mention a few quick things. First, if you loved this episode, please share it with a friend. Just shoot them a message with the link, which you can do right from your podcast app. Or I would love it if you post a screenshot of this episode to your social media or your Instagram story, and then just make sure you tag me at Hey Presley so I definitely see it and can thank you. And if you haven't yet, please do subscribe to the show so you don't miss upcoming episodes. As always, any references, tools, or links mentioned in this episode are right there in the show notes for your convenience. And if you have any questions for me, suggestions for the show, anything like that, shoot me a message on Instagram, again, at Hey Presley, or at podcast@heypresley.com. Thank you so much for listening, and make it a great day.